Dan Walters has been a journalist for over 65 years. God, I'm 69 years old, so he's been at it for a while, spending all but a few of those years working for California newspapers. At one point, at age 22, he was the nation's youngest daily newspaper editor. After three newspaper editor positions, he joined the Sacramento Union's Capital Bureau in 1975. In 81, Walters began writing the state's only daily newspaper column devoted to California political, economic, and social events. In 1984, he wrote the book, 1984. No, he moved to the Sacramento Bee, and he has written more than 10,000 columns about California and its politics, and his columns appeared in dozens of California newspapers. Midway in 2017, Dan left the Sacramento Bee and went online to CalMatters, calmatters.org. Welcome back to Radio Real Estate, Dan Walters.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Always good to talk to you. Not too long ago, you were in Santa Barbara speaking to a sold-out house at the Libero Theater. Congratulations on drawing a big crowd. And I hope you didn't mind that before security removed me, I was heckling you.
No, I didn't hear the heckling. It would have been interesting.
I'm not sure what I could have said to heckle you, but it was just a nice thought. And I do get Dan's columns. Did they recently name it Weekly Walters?
No, that's been along there for a long time. You sign up and you get all four columns of that week on Friday.
Well, I've been getting it forever, and for some reason I never noticed it. I like the name Weekly Walters. Couple of columns you wrote recently. First one in this segment we'll talk about, entitled, you know, but before I bring that up, I understand you were recently at an event, a scholarship event for journalists. What's that about?
Yes, the Sacramento Press Club has been awarding scholarships to college journalism students for the last about 40 years. I started out with one scholarship, and as of today, we awarded 13 scholarships to college journalism students, totaling about $90,000. In fact, since we started the program back in, 45 years ago or whatever, we've put out over $800,000 in scholarships to journalism students. And we now offer them from as high as $10,000 down to $6,000. And we awarded 13 scholarships at a luncheon today in Sacramento.
And you've been involved with this forever?
I actually was the president of the press club at one point in the late 70s, but I've always been a member, but I only recently got involved, heavily involved. I ran for treasurer to become the treasurer club with the expressed hope of increasing the scholarship program by raising more money. And that's been successful. So we were able to raise the amount this year from last year, $66,000 for 11 scholarships, to this year, $90,000 for 13 scholarships. And I'm hoping we can increase it even more. It's quite a project. And believe me, the money is really well received by the students, given the cost of going to college these days.
It seems like, I don't know if this was a column you wrote or something, a sub-column, where you mentioned journalists versus YouTubers, is that right?
Yeah, that's actually my column, my current column. You see a lot of stuff on YouTube and other outlets, other media, that people get on there and they profess to be journalists of a sort, and they're saying, I got to tell you something here that's going to really blow your mind. And the mainstream press is ignoring this. They're not covering it, but I'm covering it for you. Something along those lines. And it's a very common thing. And I see them all the time on YouTube. And I'm always kind of cringe when I see, because most of the things that they're there are absolutely untrue or have been just blown up way out of proportion. And these people do this, and they're convincing their viewers, I presume, that they are really telling you something that you would never find out anywhere else. And then they're always to make a pitch for money to keep this going, to keep this project going. And it's irritating to me as a professional journalist to see people trying to essentially pretend to be a investigative journalist or something of that nature, a watchdog on these things. And I hope people aren't not gullible enough to believe all these things, but I suspect that they will. And so my column was about that, and then gave examples of real journalism that really meant something. Four recent examples of that.
You know, my guest, Dan Walters, a syndicated columnist now with Cal Matters, calmatters.org. A friend of mine is addicted to TikTok, and she's a mature woman, and she just can't get off of it, and she can't help but share them with me. And sometimes it just gets overwhelming, and sometimes I'll listen to something and then I'll Google it to see if it has any basis in reality. Everyone's got a mic, everyone's got the ability now, and you don't know what's real and what's not real, so it's fraught with
it's really kind of frightening in a way to see how so much
content
misinformation is out there to influence gullible people who just don't want to take the time to actually find out whether they're being told the truth or not. And it exacerbates the polarization of politics. It's a bad thing. It's the only way I can describe it. It's just a bad thing.
Okay, well, you got your scholarship going, and you'll keep journalism alive, keep hope alive, and journalism alive. So Dan Walters, another column, recently titled "Californians Despair About High Cost of Housing, This Type of Housing Can Help." That's the title, and my question is it in Texas?
Is what in Texas?
You said this housing can help.
Oh. No,
I expected a laugh out of that line.
Well, people do move to Texas to find housing. It's a well-known phenomenon that there is an exodus of people outside, out of California to Texas, looking for an easier cost of living situation. And of course, we're also losing a lot of corporate headquarters to Texas. There's a steady stream of those moving as well. They get tired of California's regulation and taxes policy and everything, and they're going. No, but what I was really talking about is the idea that if we would adopt factory housing made in factories as opposed to being stick built on the scene, that could save a lot of money. The main problem of housing in California simply is it's so bloody expensive to build it. I mean, terribly. An apartment unit of so-called low-income or affordable housing, that sort of thing. A small apartment in California costs an average of about $750,000 to build.
Per unit.
And it's in the coastal areas in San Francisco and probably in Santa Barbara, it's more like $1 million a unit. At the very rock bottom, it's about $500,000 a unit. But think about that. A small apartment costing $500,000 minimum to build. That's obscene when you think about it. And there's a lot of reasons for it. A lot of fees, the local government's thing, a lot of the red tape, all sorts of reasons why it happens. But one of them is just simply the construction cost itself. After you go through all the fees and all the other stuff, then you're left with the construction. And that's expensive in California as well. Because the construction unions insist that public housing or money that the housing projects that are aided by public funds like the state also have to use union labor. And that's one of the most expensive things there are. So the way around that, one way around that, is factory built housing, where you can build units more quickly and a lot less expensively. If it's done, if all the components are done in a factory and simply assembled on site, either partially or fully on site. And it's something that the unions hate, and they pull their strings in local governments, particularly, to make that difficult, if not impossible, to do. But if you're really interested in trying to lower the cost of housing for people who are not wealthy, for people, working class people, then that's the sort of thing that we should be doing. And I quote a study on that explains how that could save a lot of money.
My guest is Dan Walters, syndicated columnist for 65 years, and you can find him at calmatters.org. Calmatters.org. I get his articles delivered to my email, and you can sign up for that as well. It seems to me Sears started building houses, factory-built housing, didn't they?
Yeah, you back in the 19th century, if you're out there on the plains in Nebraska and you want a house, you could actually order a house from Sears and they would send you a prefabricated house that you just had to put together. All the pieces were there, you put it together, a kit, essentially. And a lot of those houses are still standing. I mean, this is not a new concept when you think about it. And I also point out in that column that California. Henry J. Kaiser, back during World War II, pioneered the use of production line to build ships, Liberty ships. And they were building Liberty ships literally in a matter of days rather than the months it took for an ordinary kind of construction. So that, and it was because a lot of the components were prefabricated in factories and then brought to the shipyard and bolted all together, or welded, actually welded together, to create these Liberty ships. And it worked. And it's the same concept of doing that for housing. If it worked for Liberty ships in World War II, why wouldn't it do for housing in 2026?
And the technology is getting fairly advanced, and I didn't have time to pull it up, but my nephew had sent me a website of a company. I'm not even sure they might be in Canada, and they're endeavoring to do exactly what you're proposing and to do it mainstream. And the owner replied to me. I invited him for an interview, but he said he was just buried. So I guess that's a good thing, but hopefully in the coming months I'll have him on to discuss what he's doing. Over the years, I know I interviewed somebody, it's called cargo texture instead of architecture, where they take cargo containers and put them
Yes,
together for how you're familiar with that?
I've seen many of them
Yeah.
on the internet,
Yeah.
and it's yeah. I mean, it's a great thing. You know, it's the funny thing about this is that the main handicap to doing this is government, local government regulations that dictate housing, how housing ought to be built, and state regulations and state insistence that it not be manufactured housing, that it instead be stick-built housing to satisfy the unions. The state can't get the money to put money into these projects unless they agree that they'll be built on-site with union labor. And that raises the cost tremendously. Now, I appreciate why the unions want it. They don't want to lose their jobs. But remember, their jobs would still be there, but they would be in the factories where assembly lines, where they're the components are cut by laser thing, perfectly, uniform, and can easily be constructed. There's actually one project in downtown San Francisco that was done that way over the objections of unions, and the unions have pledged that they'll never allow that to happen again in San Francisco.
Wow. Now, of course, once it arrives, there's labor. You need to build a foundation. There's still some work, but obviously the lion's share of the work will be done elsewhere, and the contractors would have to move. And so it is definitely threatening their livelihood. I just read right before our interview here that on March 10th, 2026, Wyoming Republican Governor Mark Gordon now requires local government to approve or deny building permits in 30 days after application.
Yeah, there's a book just came out. I haven't written about it yet, but I'm going to, that describes best practices all over the United States for encouraging housing construction. They have case by case, city by city, cities that have reformed their rules, states that have reformed their rules. There's one locality singled out in California that has for praise for doing that. You want to guess what town it is?
I can't guess.
Sacramento.
Oh.
Sacramento has been building housing like crazy. I can't even begin to describe how many multi-story apartment projects have been built in and around the central part of Sacramento in the last, say, since the pandemic. I mean, I'm amazed how every time I go downtown, there's another project going on. Sacramento has really been doing its job in increasing the housing supply, putting other cities to shame, I would say.
Well, in Santa Barbara County, they just approved several projects, apartments. Basically, I'm calling it all on one parcel. They're four parcels, but they're virtually all contiguous. And they're dumping an amazing amount of, they're building 25% of everything they need to build by 2030. They're putting it in one spot. They bypass traditional traffic mitigation issues. It's going to create a nightmare of congestion. It's already in a congested area. And I think it's more than NIMBYism that, you know, I'm complaining about it. You know, I know we need to build, but there's a lot of land, and it's not all in, you know, in Santa Barbara on these coastal towns. There's a lot of land in California, but everybody wants to make it so you can live anywhere you want, but that's not the way it goes. My guess.
Well, you know, as well as I do, that the state has quotas.
Right.
For cities and counties to, they don't, not quota to build, but it's quota to make land zoned for a certain number of housing projects. I think what's happening in some places, and it sounds like it's happening in Santa Barbara, is that they're just packing them all into one locale, which is not a smart thing to do. They should be, if they were spread out more, smaller projects dispersed more, there then wouldn't be the impact of traffic and the other problems that caught that are there. I think it's kind of loving it to death, so to speak. They're saying, okay, you want housing? We'll just put it all right here. Well, that's not the right thing to do.
You know, no. That'll be a nice segue to our second segment with my guest, Dan Walters from calmatters.org, where we're going to talk about the governor's race and some different approaches and whether or not there'll be some backlash from the electoral here in electorate in California, and people are going to be upset with the way things are going, and will that change the governor's race? TV trivia question: Republican Governor Mark Gordon. What character Mark Gordon? What TV show was Mark Gordon on?
I can't remember. No, I don't know.
That, you know why you don't know that? Because you spend all your time reading books, and I spend my time watching television.
Or watching, or playing, what, reading comic books or something?
No, watching television. The television show was Highway to Heaven.
I remember the name, yeah.
With Victor French played Mark Gordon, and the main star. It's funny, I can't even think of the main star. He played, he was on Bonanza. Poor guy died young.
You talked about it. I remember the name. I have his face in my mind, but I can't remember the name. It was French, right?
What's that?
It was French, his name?
Victor French was the guy who played Mark Gordon.
Right, yeah.
And then the angel was played by, it's funny, he's one of those famous actors. Okay, we'll figure it out during the break. You're listening to Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, radioreelestate.com. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with my guest, Dan Walters, and we'll talk about the governor's race, and maybe how housing will play into that. Stay tuned. You'll be right back.